Welcome to Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. The leak of the Pandora Papers went off like a bombshell. A trove of nearly 12 million confidential documents, the papers reveal how the wealthy use secret offshore companies to hide their assets. The Pandora Papers investigation also shows how banks and law firms work closely with offshore service providers to design complex corporate structures to hide transactions and avoid taxes. The investigation is the world's largest ever journalistic collaboration, involving more than 600 journalists from 150 media outlets in 117 countries. And joining us to explain more about the papers and the potential fallout, we're so pleased to be joined once again by Kevin Hall, the North America editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, whose mission is to expose crime and corruption so the public can hold power to account. Kevin is overseeing the project's investigations in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. So, Kevin, it's great to have you back on Your Call, and congratulations to you and everyone who's been part of the Pandora Papers.
Thanks a lot. We were a much smaller part, but takes a village.
Absolutely. Well, so this investigation is led by the International Center for Investigative Reporting, and this recent expose follows previous revelations that I'm sure listeners are familiar with, like the Panama Papers in 2016, Paradise Papers in 2017, and on and on. And what we keep seeing over and over again is how the political elites, both former and present, and famous and rich people have been using tax havens to hide their money and pay little taxes. But before we dive in and talk about that, I just want to talk about some of the media logistics here. I mentioned more than 600 journalists and 140 media organizations, 117 countries involved in pouring over almost 12 million leaked documents. This is the biggest journalism partnership in history. So how did you keep it secret? This has been in the works for 2 years, right?
Yeah, I mean, it puzzled me in the Panama Papers that we were able to, and I had bet on certain places that it would come out, because part of the challenges of something like this is you always have elections, or you're sitting on information that might affect an election or might affect a court case. And, you know, there's a lot of temptation to give an exception, let something like this come out a little early because so-and-so needs to have it for their particular country. But no, ICIJ does a wonderful job of making sure everybody's locked down on this. And we all, you know, it's been enough of these projects now that a lot of us have been on multiple. So, you know, what the rules are, you know, what not to say, and you're very careful about what you share. And then you have timetables. I mean, obviously, we don't go to the people we're writing about very late in the process, because they do try to get out in front of it. I'll note that the president of Panama, the ex-president of Panama, Martinelli, when we got to that end point on this project, he tried to front run it by actually publishing ICIJ's letter to him about his account. So, you know, that's the kind of thing you're up against.
Well, it's really amazing how everyone was able to keep it secret and go over so many documents. But let's just kind of start with the basics on the documents. Can you explain maybe what are some of the top level findings from these from the release of the papers that you think are really noteworthy for the public?
Yeah, I think the key takeaway is more than 300 politicians around the world, 35 presidents or ex-presidents, 14 of those in Latin America. Latin America features fairly heavily in this, as it did in the Panama Papers. You know, those are kind of the big takeaways. The Tony Blair's wife purchasing a shell company that owned the property that resulted in a big windfall in taxes. Very parallel to Cameron, the prime minister, and during the Panama Papers, who eventually resigned. Putin's alleged mistress and her child, big part of it. The president of Ecuador closing Panama Papers, Panama shell companies after the Panama Papers, opening a South Dakota trust. The Washington Post did a wonderful job with ICIJ rooting out the details of 206 trusts, which are very complex financial instruments designed to shield assets. So basically, South Dakota has become the British Virgin Islands for people around the world to try to lock away access to their assets. And the president of Ecuador was one who fell into that category. Some of the other curiosities, the brother of the Argentine former president, 4 weeks after Macri became president of Argentina, his brother opened a Belize shell company that was never declared, a whole range around the world. But the key thing is, as I've said elsewhere, this, if you thought that Mossack Fonseca was kind of the outlier and that, you know, things, bad things only happen there and everybody else is kind of playing by the rules, not so. This is kind of more of what we've come to expect, that once you peel back, you know, put a little light on it, you see what's really there. And some, you know, OCCRP, my new organization, has got 41 stories that, that we've been doing. And, you know, from the a former mayor who boasted that if you can prove that I own these off these apartments, I'll give you the keys. And now they're asking for the keys because they proved the so the Zeri longtime ruling family, the Aliyevs, you know, property held in London in the name of an 11-year-old. I mean, it's kind of what you thought of would be there, but on steroids.
Wow. Well, and it's quite a cast of characters. And I'm wondering if any of these individuals also showed up in some of the past papers that were released, like the Panama papers. Are any repeat offenders here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a whole cast of them from the from Venezuela in particular, involved with the kind of siphoning off of funds from the state oil company. Some of the people in Putin's inner circle. It's led some to kind of grumble, oh, well, this is, you know, nothing new. Yeah, some of this is not new, but it's giving more details. And there's a story coming out that's already come out through a Venezuelan publication that that kind of closes the loop on who actually owns a shell company involved in the building of the metro stations in Caracas, where just gobs and millions of were siphoned off. And so, yeah, that a lot of that was out there. But what wasn't out there, what was missing, was that missing piece that showed this is the account of that person. So that's there. So there's a lot of that as well, because these all have kind of built on each other.
And can you explain how these tax havens work? I mean, I think a lot of people get the concept that there's money being, you know, kind of massed and held in shell companies. But how does it actually work in practice with some of these particularly egregious examples?
Yeah, well, let me give you a non-egregious example, potentially non-egregious, but why they're so vexing. We did a story in the Miami Herald with partners at, in Spain, and looked at Julio Iglesias. You know, you don't think of Julio Iglesias as a particularly toxic person or anything like that. But he owns a lot more property than anybody was aware of. And we discovered that in finding a trust and then in finding about 20 shell companies that were all mostly in the British Virgin Islands, that then pointed to companies that existed in the Florida corporate registry under names that you wouldn't necessarily associate with him or his family. What exactly each one did or held, kind of hard to determine, but we know that they were able to kind of establish the ownership structure. So a lot of them did hold that, but he also had shell companies that would have appear to be for royalties and shell companies that appeared for his yacht. Now, none of that is necessarily illegal, but then it begs the question, where is he filing his taxes? He's a Spaniard. He's got residence in Miami. His main residence seems to be Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic. So it's really for tax authorities to determine, is he paying what he's supposed to be paying? And then the question is, do they do that? And that's not public information. That there is the rub, that you don't have, you don't know whether they're actually paying their fair share. You know, they say, yes, I am. Well, prove it. Well, I'm not going to show you my tax documents. You go to the authorities. Well, it's, you know, private information. We can't say that. So, you know, that's how they camouflage. Now, that's kind of a good use, or at least a more obviously legal use. But there are, for instance, in the Panama Papers, we had in Wyoming, you had Russians setting up shell companies in Wyoming that had assets, you know, somewhere else in Singapore or around the world. And they just chose Wyoming because it was a form of camouflage. And it was the actual contract for like a railway equipment purchase that was made in Sweden. But the actual contract is held to a company in Wyoming and the bank accounts are in Switzerland. So what you're doing is just creating this complex trail for anybody trying to follow the money or claw back any of that money if there was fraud. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, it sounds like, in other words, these are basically legal structures, but there may be tax evasion. And so then the question is, are our tax enforcers following through? But that information is confidential. So if I'm right on that, or if I'm stating that correctly, then does that mean that we don't really know what the fallout is from the release of these papers, that there could be enforcement actions taken that's just confidential?
Yeah, and in many cases, that's the case. Now, you know, again, these things all build on each other, right? So a couple of years back, there was the FinCEN files, which was the leak of suspicious activity reports. Well, that's where you see where an authority, the Financial Investigative Agency or unit in the British Virgin Islands, for instance, you see in there all these suspicious activity reports filed by offshore providers about the people, about particular shell companies who've been associated either in the news or through an arrest. And then they're telling the authorities, hey, this shell company is accused of this. We're alerting you and we're resigning. So all of this happens underneath the surface that none of us get to see. And you assume the authorities are doing something with this information. But if that authority is in Azerbaijan, or that authority is in Bosnia, or that authority is in Argentina, there's a good chance that things aren't actually being done. And these are places where the rule of law is weak, where governments tend not to be transparent, et cetera. And that's how it amplifies.
Well, and one of the interesting revelations is not just about these offshore tax havens, but how wealthy people are hiding their money here in the U.S. And you mentioned South Dakota, and the investigation identified 206 U.S.-based trusts linked to 41 countries, and nearly 30 of the trusts held assets connected to people or companies accused of fraud, bribery, human rights abuses in some of the world's most vulnerable communities. But South Dakota is actually one of the states that promised protection for many of these individuals due to their policies that are luring in this wealth. And other states competing include Alaska, Delaware, Nevada, New Hampshire. Can you describe a little bit about why what these states are doing, why they're competing for this wealth? And I mean, why South Dakota?
Yeah, with the caveat that I didn't work on this part of the story, but that actually was kind of an evolution from a story that we did in 2016 about Wyoming and Nevada being kind of the haven for the actual shell companies. As those companies, after our reporting there, both states changed their rules about, you know, what contacts and you know, you couldn't completely camouflage who owns something. That's what's so striking about South Dakota, that it seemed to kind of open itself up and say, we'll take you. And it's, again, through a complex structure that it's a trust structure that makes it hard to have any sort of public reference to find it. Well, the Washington Post story, together with ICIJ, highlighted a bunch of real world examples. They did a very good job of this, of showing in a real world how these things were used to hide assets. So there was one case where a divorce, they were using that to kind of change how much someone was getting in child alimony payments from a wealthy person. Another had to do with abuse victims and shielding the perpetrator of abuse, shielding assets so the victims couldn't claw them back. It's odd that they would want to be, a state would want to be associated with something like this. And one of the important things to understand is there aren't required of lawyers the same know your customer rules that banks are. So we've really cracked down on banks. You have to really know your customer, know where their source of income is, but they're gaping holes. Lawyers argue, well, you can't make us subject to this because it's attorney-client privilege. And then example, a story that I moved today on the Trump Hotel in Panama that was bought by a Cypriot, Mr. Fintinklis. The private equity world also reveals almost nothing about who their investors are, even less if they're not based in the U.S. and you know, tied to the U.S. Financial system. So there are all these places where you can just completely hide in anonymity or structure and layer things so that, you know, anybody who's wronged can't get to them. And, you know, there's a certain degree of that with taxes. This isn't even getting to the taxes. This is more about asset protection.
Well, it certainly feeds a lot of cynicism to hear about the lengths that the wealthy and powerful are going to. And if you're just joining us, this is Your Call. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is our media roundtable. And we're talking about the bombshell release of the Pandora Papers, and we're joined by Kevin Hall, the North American editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. So, Kevin, I wanted to ask you about one of the particular stories in there, because it implicates the situation potentially in Haiti, which, of course, is in the news for multiple reasons, from the recent assassination of the Haitian president to immigrants leaving Haiti and trying to get into the United States. But one of the stories involved a Miami real estate tycoon, Gilbert Biggio, is a wealthy Haitian businessman and sometimes Miami resident. Can you explain a little bit about what you found out about him and how he has benefited from these secret offshore accounts?
Right. We found him earlier. That was my story. And it was curious, when you've done this long enough in these projects, one of the first things you do is kind of dig out people's passports, in part because, you know, if your passport's in there, you can't say, "I didn't know," right? I mean, that's kind of a starting point. It kind of shows there was a willful intent to create one of these companies. So as going, you know, in pulling all the Haiti passports, was able to find the Biggios and then research them further. And we decided to write about them in part because it came against this backdrop of what was going on with the assassination of the president and the absolute turmoil. And then on top of that, the terrible earthquake. And the Biggios are among, if not the most wealthy family in Haiti. They come in and out, have a place in Indian Creek, which is the most exclusive area of Miami. They've had that since the mid-90s. And as we understand it, the elder Biggio lives in Paris mostly. But they, the juxtaposition of someone who controls the, you know, build a private port, has the exclusive distribution rights for Kraft and Goya Foods, who's part of the cell phone, invested in the cell phone company there, exporting fuels and having the Texaco concession from Chevron. Basically, they touch everything that goes in and out of Haiti in some way. And then Haiti has terrible tax collection. There's no, you know, who knows how much they actually pay in taxes in Haiti. That's certainly not public. And everybody agrees that Haiti doesn't do a great job of collecting taxes by virtue of its government structure being in such a shambles. Not a Miami resident, has dual residency with France, unclear where they pay their taxes, Swiss bank accounts. So, you know, do the authorities go after someone like that? I don't know. But what we've tried to do is point out how someone so fabulously wealthy creates parallel shell companies for everything they do. And a lot of that money ends up in Switzerland. And where you go with that, with the regulators, will be interesting.
Well, I want to let listeners know that if you have any questions about the Pandora Papers, we would love to hear from you, and you can direct your questions to Kevin Hall. We're very pleased to be joined with. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you have questions about Pandora Papers or thoughts about what should be done in response, you can also email us at yourcall@kalw.org, or you can tweet us a question at yourcallradio. Kevin, just following up on the Biggio family and Haiti, we know that Haiti has been suffering from decades of corruption, rising inequalities, rising gang violence, political turmoil. And I'm wondering if this flight capital from Haiti that we're seeing with people like Gilbert Biggio has had an impact on the overall economy there and corruption. Are you getting a sense that this is affecting politics in Haiti domestically?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it doesn't take much of a stretch to think about all the powerful, wealthy families in Haiti, and it's a small number who have very concrete interests in Haiti. And then think about shell companies and transfer of money. Now, we didn't find any evidence of that, but it's not the kind of thing that would be obvious either. And the question is, how does this money end up in the hands of, To take it a step further in the complex investigation into the murder of the president, you know, who paid for Colombian commandos? How were they first signed up? How did the Florida company get paid? Where did it get paid? You know, through what mechanism? I think over time, that if there's a federal, there's a federal investigation, if there are federal indictments, we might get a sense of the shell company activity in that. But, you know, since the end of the Duvalier dictatorship in 86, I believe it was, you know, these oligarchs have influenced heavily who comes up through the ranks. And, you know, like any country, people do better under one guy or another guy. It's still, since 86 forward, has kind of been a heads I win, tails you lose. You know, the rich have gotten extremely richer, particularly after 2004.
No, it's definitely a tragic situation there in Haiti. Well, we do have a caller. We have William dialing in from Belvedere. William, welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you very much. I know that the job of an investigative reporter is really just to report upon the results of their investigations. However, as a what you might describe consumer of information, what has troubled me, and perhaps my impression is not correct, is that there have been, during the last several years, repeated revelations of perfidy with hidden bank accounts, trusts, and whatever. The Panama Papers, now these papers, the HSBC investigation where they were laundering drug money in Mexico. But what I don't hear about is any concrete results. Now, HSBC did get to pay a fine, but it didn't hurt them. I would appreciate it if the guest could, if there have been, cite examples where these revelations have actually led to prosecutions or some other significant change that has affected somebody.
All right. I think it's a great question. Jack, go ahead, Kevin, please.
Yeah, the great question and a very fair question. And to the first point, I think any reporter worth their salt is an investigative reporter. That's the whole point of reporting. The distinction being that people who are called investigative reporters, and I'm only recently thrown into that category, tend to work longer on a story. It may take months to get a story, and it often involves building big databases and cross-referencing data and running it against other data. So it's a technical thing. But the broader question of whether there are results, right? I mean, that's been one of the questions on the Panama paper. How come no big fish have been hit? There have been a number of smaller players who have been hit, and it's a fair question. I know I've joined in August, joined OCCRP, and their goal is always to try to do the kind of story that a Transparency International or a prosecutor can come behind and act on it. So that's, they don't do a story, we don't do a story, if there isn't an ability to come up behind it and have some sort of concrete action that will remedy it. So that's a kind of a unique mission that they have. And then the rest is staying on people to ask more about this. So, you know, one of the great frustrations is we don't have, you know, FinCEN isn't transparent by virtue of what they do. They don't tell us, you know, they publish a sanctions list or they publish settlements, but there's precious little that points to what they do. All we can do by proxy is look at what their budget is, for example. And, you know, I suspect they go after cases. It's the old scare, you know, kill the chicken to scare the monkey reference, you know, try to find cases that scare others in the business, but they're not manned to aggressively go after large volumes of these people, unfortunately.
All right. Well, thank you, William, for that question. And Kevin, I wanted to ask you, in addition to any prosecutions, I think William asked a really important question there, and sort of criminal conviction or financial conviction follow-up, what about policy changes? Have you seen any policy changes based on previous revelations, and would you anticipate any from this revelation?
Well, I'd like to be more optimistic but unfortunately it took probably almost 6 years to get some changes to beneficial owner language passed through the U.S. Congress, and it was kind of the lowest common denominator. Not to criticize it, it was a heavy lift just to get something basic done. I think the Europeans have moved more aggressive than we have in terms of a registry of beneficial owners. Their enforcement leaves a lot to be desired, but at least there is now you know, mechanisms in place where on both sides of the Atlantic were starting to really be more transparent about beneficial ownership. The flip side of that is what, you know, the Post and the ICIJ showed with the trusts and how the United States itself, you know, is a harbor for this stuff. And I'm pretty confident that if you had the Delaware leaks, and I'm not saying that's out there, but if hypothetically you had the Delaware leaks, I think you would find very much the same pattern as we found elsewhere, that people are using Delaware in its camouflage that it offers, you know, the same kinds of things. Would they, you know, do they have the ability to determine somebody is a political exposed person? You know, are U.S. agents going to be required to do the same as a Panamanian law firm and find out whether, you know, their persons, you know, are on any sort of checklist? In the U.S., we, you know, we're good at pointing the finger, but we don't do a very good job ourselves of policing the money that comes in here.
Well, and Kevin, for listeners who are upset hearing about what's happening and want to advocate for policy change, what would you recommend? What would be some of the policies that you think could help address what we're seeing with these papers, whether it's policies here in the U.S. or abroad or even state-based?
Yeah, well, and again, with that caveat that I'm not optimistic because most of the Congress is lawyers, and lawyers are kind of the ones who are benefiting the most from this system. But, you know, I think it just seems a no-brainer to have a bona fide, you know, registry of beneficial owners. And, you know, there's been argument about, well, what is a beneficial owner? Do they have to have more than 25% of a company? What's the threshold? You know, I think it's kind of like the old saying about pornography. You know it when you see it. Owners, you know who is whom trying to create these sort of mechanisms. So the start, I think, pressure to have a bona fide, real beneficial registers, a registry of beneficial owners that is accessible to law enforcement and that law enforcement is actually encouraged to police this. You know, we were very good about terror financing after 9/11, and it really changed the financial system in a way in terms of patrolling for that. But this is a huge risk. I mean, all these leaks after leaks show that it's a national security risk. It undermines our drug enforcement efforts. It certainly undermines patent protection and kind of basic rule of law things we have here in the United States and in much of the world. So those are two things. And, you know, actually putting money behind these things, you know, do the DEA, does Treasury's FinCEN actually have the funds needed to realistically go after this money, you know, follow the money?
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, I have to ask the last question as we wrap up this segment. Can we expect more releases like this? And I guess a related question, are these people on the inside who are releasing these documents who are upset about what they're seeing, the type of corruption that they're seeing? Do you have any sense as to who these whistleblowers are, as well as if more might be coming down the pipe?
Yeah, I won't characterize any. I just think there's a danger in making any characterization of where information comes from. Death by a thousand disclosures. So I'll pass on people's motives or how these things came about. But I do think that there's little sign. There are plenty of places around the world that we still haven't seen. And I think whatever people's motives are or whomever is behind these sorts of things, I don't think we've seen the last of it. And I think, you know, in a world with less transparency and the fact that, you know, these offshore providers are now simply trying to find better mousetraps, so to speak, build better mousetraps, I do think this issue isn't going away anytime soon.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned. Thank you so much for joining us, Kevin Hall, North American editor of Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Thanks so much for joining us on your call today, Kevin.
Great questions. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And we'll be back just after this. You're listening to Your Call.